Starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's JNEB Journal Club webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB and glad to have you join us for the presentation today. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see a handout available. Our presenter has made the slides available to you so you can take notes and follow along during the discussion. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question box so we can moderate those to the presenter. When I close out the webinar today, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this presentation as well as ideas for future sessions. And then watch for an email from me on Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording that we're making, the slides available, and then the CEU certificate that you're earning with your attendance today. So we have our moderator back this week. Virginia Quick is Assistant Research Professor at Rutgers University in the School of Environmental and Biological Sciences.
Great. Thank you, Rachel, and I'm glad to be back. And we're very excited today to have Dr. Carly Pakanowski. She's very passionate about the study of obesity, eating disorders, and weight control behaviors since the beginning of her career. She has her PhD in nutritional sciences from Cornell University, and also is a registered dietitian. She has completed an NIH-funded postdoc in obesity prevention at the University of Minnesota, followed by an NIH-funded postdoc in eating disorders at the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute. Dr. Pakanowski is now an assistant professor in the Department of Behavioral Health and Nutrition at the University of Delaware, where she continues her investigation of weight control behaviors and their relationship to health. And we're very excited to have her talk today about some of her work that she's done looking at self-weighing throughout adolescence and young adulthood, implications for well-being.
Thank you very much for that gracious introduction, Dr. Quick, and thanks, Rachel, for answering all of my questions regarding this webinar. I'm really excited to have this opportunity to speak to those of you listening from the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior and share information from this manuscript that was published in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior in 2015. So, trying to advance the slide, doesn't seem to, let's see, there we go. So there's a nice, since we're online, there's a nice proper stock photo, and you can pretend like that's how professional I look as I'm giving this presentation. As Ginger said, I have a new role as assistant professor in a great department of behavioral health and nutrition at the University of Delaware that's allowing me to continue some of the work we're going to discuss today. And there's my email address in case anyone would like to get in contact with me at a later date about anything discussed today. To outline what I'll be talking about, I'm going to put self-weighing in a broader context and kind of explain the way I approach it. I approach thinking about self-weighing in the broader umbrella of my research program. And then I will discuss Project EAT, which is a large cohort study at the University of Minnesota, because that's where the data for this particular study that we're discussing today came from. And then I'll specifically go into this manuscript, the methods and the three learning objectives outlined for this presentation. Finally, I'll talk about some exciting future work that I'm getting ready to do, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. So in 2013, Swan defined the quantified self as any individual engaged in the self-tracking of any kind of biological, physical, behavioral, or environmental information. There's a proactive stance towards obtaining information and acting on it. A variety of areas may be tracked and analyzed. For example, weight, energy level, mood, time usage, sleep quality, health, cognitive performance, athletics, and learning strategies. And I think this term of the quantified self or the quantified self movement really applies to us as healthcare practitioners, graduate students, or researchers in the healthcare fields, because it's an up-and-coming thing that's going on all around us. If any of you use Fitbits or have clients or know of, see people using Fitbits to track things like number of steps taken per day or minutes of activity, or using apps like MyFitnessPal or many of the other hundreds of apps out there to track calorie counting, all of this self-tracking is a very interesting way that individuals are collecting self-relevant data and using it over time. And I've become very interested in if this quantification, numerification of health information promotes health and well-being. And so the primary way I've looked at this since my career started in graduate school is through self-weighing. So thinking of self-weighing and weight over long periods of time as the measure of energy input versus energy output. So tracking of weight over time will be referred to as self-weighing here. And to give you a little bit of research background, evidence suggests that there's potential benefit for self-weighing in terms of weight loss, prevention of weight gain, and prevention of age-related weight gain. Years ago, Rena Wing and Jim Hill started a self-selecting group called the National Weight Control Registry, which is a group of individuals who lost at least 30 pounds and kept it off for at least a year. And at least in the U.S., we know that weight loss and prevention of weight regain is relatively rare given the current environment, which some have described as obesogenic. So it's been interesting to learn what these individuals do, and one of the practices that they engage in is frequent self-weighing. In fact, over a third of members from the National Weight Control Registry report weighing themselves daily. Now, there's a lot of research done, it's a growing field, on self-weighing in adults for the different types of weight control. I'm focusing in this presentation on the research that I've personally been involved with because that kind of shapes how I came to be interested in this topic. But I will say, if anyone's interested in other references, I know of at least three other reviews that have covered self-weighing, and also our moderator, Dr. Virginia Quick, has published two articles on self-weighing. So I'm just selecting a few articles that I can personally speak to. So for my dissertation work, I conducted a two-year study it was a randomized controlled trial where we gave overweight and obese adults a scale and asked half of them to weigh themselves every day and track their weight over time. And so what you see here is just typical bathroom scale. Actually, it's an icon. And this program where people were told to log in and enter their weight every day. And I just want to make this clear because self-weighing the way we conceptualize it doesn't have to be just stepping on the scale every day, but actually monitoring a weight trend over time. And in this way, we kind of switch our frame of reference from a number to a long-term biofeedback of biological information. So this person can see on their weight graph over a long period of time, years, the weight's going down. So it's been suggested that this procedure could be a way of monitoring environmental impact through eating behaviors and physical activity on weight, so that people can notice a trend of weight going up or down before it gets to be an amount which is going to put them at health risk. So in this study, we found that daily self-weighing and tracking did help obese and overweight adults lose weight and keep it off over a two-year period. More recently, studies and my collaborators in this field use technological advances such as wireless scales. This is a picture of a Withing scale that automatically transmits weight information to a participant's smartphone or computer. And on the right, we see a graph here. And this gets at another point. I think that daily weighing has been criticized because of the fluctuation in body weight on a day-to-day basis. And though weight fluctuates, over long periods of time, we can see general trends. So something that became really interesting to me in conducting my dissertation project was talking with and interviewing participants and learning about the differential responses that people had to weighing themselves. For example, there were participants who originally very much disliked weighing themselves and then reframed how they thought about weight into looking at the trajectory over time and did very well in weight control over the 2 years. Then there were for other participants for whom self-weighing was adverse emotionally and wasn't beneficial. And so through this work and the idea that self-weighing might be a strategy or a tool we can give people to manage their weight, I became interested in the psychological impact of self-weighing. And so from these lovely Google stock images, we can see, you know, there are various ways in which an individual might respond to the scale. So during my postdoc at the University of Minnesota, I had the opportunity to investigate this question working with Jennifer Lindy and Diane Newmark Sr., who were collaborators on the self-weighing paper published in JNEB. And this review was conducted in 2014 and published in 2015. And we looked at the current state of the literature that discussed both self-weighing and psychological well-being. And we found 20 articles, two of which were authored by Dr. Quick, the moderator here. And we looked at these articles and found that in 10 articles that evaluated self-weighing and affect, so think mood like anxiety or depression, more self-weighing was associated with poorer affect. In 3 out of 4 articles looking at self-esteem or one's feelings of self-worth and self-weighing, in 3 out of 4 increases in higher self-esteem was associated with poorer self. I'm sorry, higher self-weighing was associated with poorer self-esteem. Body evaluation, so how one feels about one's body, body satisfaction, body dissatisfaction, in 4 out of 10 studies, more self-weighing was associated with poorer body satisfaction. And finally, eating behaviors and cognition, so things like disordered eating or weight control behaviors that could be either healthy or unhealthy, meaning on the unhealthy side, some of which we'll talk about related to the present paper, vomiting, diuretic, laxative use to control weight, but also healthy weight control behaviors like limiting use of soda or eating less sweets. About half of the articles that looked at these found a relationship between self-weighing and these eating behaviors or cognitions. A number of the studies that assessed self-weighing and psychological factors, I mentioned two of Dr. Quick's, came from this data set called Project EAT. And this data set provided the data for which the self-weighing article that I published was used from. So I'm going to briefly talk about what Project EAT is. EAT stands for Eating and Activity in Teens. And this is a really important cohort study because of the number and diversity of people that were followed over a long period of time and collected, and the information that was collected. The first survey administration of Project EAT assessed more than 4,700 adolescents in 31 metropolitan schools in Minnesota. And anthropometric measures such as weight and height were taken, and surveys were also administered to assess eating behaviors, weight concern behaviors, physical activity behaviors, and so on. As EAT progressed, the investigators designed questions and assessed more and more elements related to the individual throughout the socio-ecological model. So now there are questions about neighborhood factors and crime and safety. But for the purposes of my interest, I'm focusing on the individual level of self-weighing and psychological factors. So EAT2 was a five-year follow-up survey in 2003 to 2004. And I should have mentioned, during EAT 1, participants were on average 15 years old. During EAT 2, they were about 20 years old. And then EAT 3 followed up with 2,400 young adults when they were about 25 years old. One of the goals of Project EAT was to collect data from a racially and ethnically diverse sample so that we could investigate relationships between eating and physical activity environments in different groups. And this project has been funded by several national government agencies. EAT 1 and 2 were supported by the Maternal and Child Health Program, Title V of the Social Security Act, and the Health Resources and Services Administration Department and Health and Human Services Grant. And finally, EAT 3 was supported by a National Institutes of Health grant from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. So all the variables that I'll be talking about today, for example, self-esteem, a measurement was taken when individuals were 15 years old. I hope you can see my cursor. I'm moving it using it as like a laser pointer. But yeah, let's just hope that works. Then at 20 years old, again, and at 25 years old, allowing us to look at changes over time. So to investigate self-weighing and psychological factors over time, a team came together. Diane Newmark-Sainer is the PI of Project EAT, and she's also the chair of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota right now. Jennifer Lindy has done a lot of work and is a contact expert in self-weighing and just completed her own R01 evaluating self-weighing for weight loss in overweight and obese adults, and is also a professor in the Department of Community and Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of Minnesota. Peter Hannon has been a statistician on Project EAT for a long time and worked with several projects and several students. And finally, Dr. Katie Loaf is a faculty member in family medicine at the University of Minnesota. So we all came together to answer this question about how are psychological and behavioral factors related to self-weighing, and how does that impact well-being over this 10-year period throughout adolescence and young adulthood. And just to note here, there's the full citation of the published article. I really encourage viewers to read the full article if you're interested. I'm going to focus on three specific learning objectives today so that I can thoroughly describe how we operationalized and got results for each of these learning objectives. But the overall article provides a much richer picture and a lot more information. So for today, learning objectives are to describe the relationship between self-weighing frequency and unhealthy weight control behaviors, to understand the relationship between change in self-weighing frequency and change in psychological factors over this 10-year period, and to consider possibilities of directions of causality linking self-weighing and psychological factors. Methods. For this paper, the analytic sample was 1,902 young adults for cross-sectional analyses. This number is slightly lower than the numbers you heard. Project EAT 1 was over 4,700, and Project EAT 2 and 3 were around 2,300 to 2,400, because we selected individuals who had responses to all of the questions used to operationalize our constructs here. And the sample size is slightly less for the longitudinal analyses because we needed individuals who responded to the self-weighing items and the other items at every data point. Statistical analyses have been done, and procedures have been done to weight all Project EAT analyses to reflect the diversity of the original EAT sample. And also in this paper, all analyses looking at self-weighing and psychological factors are stratified by gender, because previous studies published on the EAT data and common sense suggest that males and females may have a different relationship to self-weighing and psychological factors. So how did we measure self-weighing? At each survey, the same question was asked. How strongly do you agree with the following statements? Statement: I weigh myself often. And response options were strongly disagree, disagree, agree, or strongly agree. Now, it's important to note that we use this item because it was asked in this exact same format at each three data collection time points over this 10-year period. But this item has been significantly correlated with another measure of self-weighing frequency, which goes something like, how often do you weigh yourself? And then response options are multiple times a day, one time a day, several times per week, weekly, monthly, never. So we use this item to assess self-weighing frequency. To assess unhealthy weight control behaviors, or UWCBs, participants were asked to indicate whether they had engaged in any of 9 behaviors over the past year. And these behaviors are categorized as less extreme and extreme. Less extreme behaviors would be fasting, eating very little food, using a food substitute, skipping meals, or smoking more cigarettes. And extreme weight control behaviors would be using laxatives, pills, diuretics, or vomiting for the purposes of controlling weight in the past year. Psychological factors, we focused on 5 here. First was weight disparity, and this is a measure calculated by asking participants, at what weight do you think you would look best? And then dividing that value by their actual self-reported weight and multiplying by 100 to derive a percent. Body satisfaction was evaluated using a modified version of the body shape satisfaction questionnaire. And also, just so everyone's aware, the psychometrics for all of the items used in Project EAT are available online, and the ones specific to this article are stated in the article. Body satisfaction had participants rate 10 different body parts using a Likert scale of 1, very dissatisfied, to 5, I love this body part. And so scores could range from 5 to 50. Weight concern was assessed from 2 items and using a 4-point Likert scale, the same Likert scale that I showed you for the self-weighing item, strongly agree to strongly disagree. The items were, I think a lot about being thinner, and I'm worried about gaining weight. And scores for weight concern ranged from 3, indicating low weight concern, to 12, indicating high weight concern. Depression, or depressive symptoms, really, were assessed using 6 items from the Candle and Davies Depressive Symptoms Scale, and scores for this sample range from 10, low depressive symptoms, to 50, high depressive symptoms. Self-esteem was assessed using 6 items from the Rosenberg Self-Esteem Scale, and scores range from 6, low or poor self-esteem, to 24, high, positive self-esteem. Okay, so results. The results are from baseline participant characteristics from Project EAT 1, and this reflects the diversity of the overall sample. If you can see in this table, at baseline, so in 1998-99, when participants were about 15 years old, about 2/3 of both female and male participants were of normal weight status, leaving 1/3 to be of non-normal weight status. Also at baseline, about 2/3 of both female and male participants, a little over 2/3, were in high school, while 1/3 were in middle school. We did check our analyses to see if school level moderated any of the findings, but it did not, so we combined that factor in analyses. And as I mentioned before, Project EAT really strove to come up with a more racially diverse sample, and so about half of female and male participants are white. There's more representation of racial minorities than we see in a lot of other studies. Same thing with socioeconomic status. We see representation across 5 socioeconomic statuses. All right, so objective 1. Describe the relationship between self-weighing frequency and unhelpful weight control behaviors. So to do this, we looked at the percentage agreement with the self-weighing item, so the percent of people who said, I strongly agree, I disagree, I strongly disagree with, I weigh myself often, and the percent who engaged in at least one less extreme or at least one extreme unhealthy weight control behavior at each time point. So this is really, again, a snapshot at each time point of what that looked like. And I'm going to go through bar charts of this split by gender. So first we have males. On the y-axis we see percents from 1 to 100. And this is for less extreme weight control behaviors. This data is organized such that the greenish blue represents eat 1, yellow eat 2, and red eat 3. So on the y-axis we see our weighing item. And of those who strongly disagreed that they weighed themselves often at eat 1, about 28% reported engaging in a less extreme weight control behavior, which, again, to remind you, could be fasting, eating very little food, using a food substitute, or skipping meals. At eat 2 for males, about 18% reported engaging in at least one of these behaviors, and in eat 3, a little over 24%. Reported engaging in at least one of these behaviors. As we go along, we can see percentages for disagree and agree. For these bar charts, I'm going to focus on the polls because that can often be more interesting. And one thing I will say is that for this objective and in the paper, this is purely descriptive. So I'm making descriptive visual evaluations. I'm not stating statistical significance here, which is just important to note. So for males who strongly agreed that they weighed themselves often, at eat 1, a little over 44% engaged in at least one less extreme unhealthy weight control behavior. This value was 47.5% at eat 2 and about 43% in eat 3. Moving on to extreme unhealthy weight control behaviors, which include laxative, pill use, diuretics, or vomiting to lose weight or prevent weight gain. Again, we have the scale from 0 to 100 and the item, I weigh myself often. In eat 1, about 4% of males who strongly disagreed with that they weighed themselves often engaged in at least one extreme unhealthy weight control behavior. In eat 2, this was about 6%, and in eat 3, about 2%. And then moving across, we see, I wouldn't say so much of any striking trend here, but of those who strongly agreed with weighing themselves often, about 8% of males engaged in one of these extreme unhealthy weight control behaviors. At eat 2, 6.5% of males engaged in at least one extreme unhealthy weight control behavior. And at eat 3, 6.9% of males. Moving on to females. So I think it's kind of interesting to see just visually the greater frequency with which females report at any of the time points engagement in at least one less extreme weight control behavior. But it makes sense, kind of, since we know these behaviors are more characteristic of females in today's society. So same thing, when we look at those who strongly disagreed with weighing themselves often, at eat 1, 43% of females engaged in at least one less extreme weight control behavior. Eat 2, 43.5%. Eat 3, 55%. And as we move through the categories, I think a trend becomes visually relevant of increasing percentages of those engaging in these behaviors with stronger agreement of weighing. So those who strongly agreed that they weighed themselves often at eat 1, over 80% engaged in at least one less extreme weight control behavior, 81% engaged in at least one less extreme weight control behavior at EAT 2, and 75% at EAT 3. Moving to extreme unhealthy weight control behaviors, we can also see a trend in females. So those who strongly disagreed, 11.5% engaged in at least one of these potentially concerning behaviors at EAT 1, 12.1% at EAT 2, and 14.7% at EAT 3. But if we look at those who strongly agreed with weighing themselves often, at EAT 1 we had about 21% agreement, at EAT 2 40% agreement, and at EAT 3 about 40% agreement. Moving on to objective 2, which was to understand the relationship between change in self-weighing frequency and change in psychological factors over a 10-year period. The analytic approach here was contemporaneous change analyses, and what that really means is the association between change in one variable and change in another variable. This was modeled using random coefficient models, so we were interested in individual change in self-weighing frequency and individual change in psychological factors over this period. So for example, if the pink line represents self-weighing frequency and in this individual it went down between EAT 1 and EAT 2, and the blue line represents weight concern, also went down between EAT 1 and EAT 2, there would be a direct relationship between these two variables as they're changing in the same way. So for males, this table shows the results, and I would like to mention I included weight and BMI in these tables, even though it's outside of the learning objective. This information is in the table, or I'm sorry, in the paper, and I think it's really interesting because we didn't find the significant relationships between weight, BMI, and self-weighing change that have been reported in the literature. And there could be several reasons for that, but I think that's also an interesting finding from this study. So on the leftmost column, we see weight, BMI, and then our five psychological factors. This column of beta coefficients to show the association of the variable in the leftmost column with a one-unit change in response to self-weighing frequency over a five-year period. Standard deviation, effect size, and p-value. In males, weight concern was the only factor significantly associated with change in weight concern was the only factor significantly associated with change in self-weighing frequency. And that relationship is described as a one-unit increase in weighing frequency. So if at EAT 1 someone picked disagree and at EAT 2 they picked agree, would be associated with a 0.53, on average, a 0.53 unit increase in their weight concern score. And if we remember, the weight concern scale range from 3 to 12. So this is a non-trivial increase. Though this result is statistically significant, the effect size is small. Moving on to females, again, we see that weight and BMI were not significantly related. Change in weight and change in BMI were not significantly related to change in weighing frequency over a five-year period. But for females, We saw significant changes in weighing frequency being significantly associated with changes in body satisfaction, weight concern, depression, and self-esteem, such that increasing weighing frequency was associated with, on average, a decrease of about a point in body satisfaction over a five-year period, an increase in weight concern, similar to what we saw with males, an increase in depressive symptoms, and a decrease in self-esteem. Again, these were all statistically significant results, though they are not, though the effect sizes were small. Moving on to objective three, consider possibilities of directions of causality linking self-weighing and psychological factors. And I picked this objective because I think, given the results, it's important to think about the study design. This study has a lot of strengths. Project EAT is one of the largest, most diverse, maybe the largest, most diverse study of this type of information, and we can get so much out of it. But we also need to think about what we can say and what we can't say from these findings. And because we didn't randomize these adolescents to a control and experimental group and have one group weigh and the other group not weigh, we can't assess the direction of causality between the psychological factors and the self-weighing here. So using females and self-esteem as an example, it is possible that, and keep in mind this list isn't exhaustive, it's just examples that I came up with, it's possible that over this 10-year period, females who weigh themselves more, increase their frequency of weighing, become overly attuned to the number on the scale. And if this number is inconsistent with what they would ideally like to weigh, their self-esteem goes down over time. It's also possible that females with decreasing self-esteem over time gravitate towards external validation of themselves instead of paying attention to self-worth coming from the inside, and self-weighing is one way to do this. Another possibility is that decreases in self-esteem and increases in self-weighing are linked by other variables that we haven't measured here, or that are either confound variables or are along a causal pathway. And a fourth possibility is that this finding was a type 1 error or false positive. Based on the literature available on self-weighing and psychological factors, I kind of am inclined to say that I doubt this was a false positive, because in 1997, Ogden and Wyman studied a group of females ranging the same age of the participants in Project EAT, and found that those randomized to a condition in which they were asked to weigh themselves every day for 2 weeks compared to those asked not to weigh themselves at all, experienced a decrease in self-esteem. More recently, Ben, Webb, Chang, and Harkin published a meta-analysis of self-weighing and psychological factors, the impact of self-weighing on psychological factors, and overwhelmingly they found that there wasn't evidence for poor psychological outcomes, but I will say a lot of these studies are weight loss studies, so improvements in psychological functioning are associated with weight loss, and the self-weighing is also associated with weight loss. But this article did find a small significant effect between increases in self-weighing and poor psychological functioning, and that included self-esteem. So given these findings, I think there's reason to believe that this could be a real finding and not a statistical fluke. Future directions. Okay, my favorite part. EAT4 has been funded and data has been collected, and I was able to sit in a couple of the planning meetings, and in addition to including this I weigh myself often strongly agree to strongly disagree question, so now we'll have 15 years of data collection from the same individuals on this item. We've also included the item assessing more objective frequency of weighing, so how often do you weigh yourself, several times a day, daily, several times a week, etc., and a new item, assessing to what degree self-weighing affects someone's mood. So I'm really excited to be working on two different papers using the data from Project EAT4. In my new position at the University of Delaware, I'm currently applying for and setting up studies to better understand who benefits from frequent self-weighing as an age-related weight gain prevention strategy. And there is research to suggest that if we can prevent weight gain, we won't have to deal with the whole weight loss, dieting, weight gain, more dieting, distress that some people go through. So I think that self-weighing is a really interesting and important tool, but I'm interested in better identifying individuals for whom it's beneficial. So one project that I'm working on is going to be a randomized pilot trial of self-weighing versus an affect-neutral behavior using ecological momentary assessment. And ecological momentary assessment is a somewhat newer research methodology that allows us to collect information from participants in real time. So the self-weighing studies that have looked at psychological outcomes review change over a 2-week period, an 8-week period, a couple months period, a 6-month period, or like Project EAT, a 5-year period. But what ecological momentary assessment can do is it can figure out how self-weighing impacts mood in the moment. So through participants' cell phones and handheld devices, we can have them weigh themselves and track that using a Wi-Fi scale and then ask them, how do you feel right now? How anxious are you right now? How do you feel about your body right now? How do you feel about your self-worth right now? So I'm in the process of setting that up and very excited. Lastly, this first picture of someone stepping on a scale that says, you are beautiful, reminds me of some of the conversations I had with participants way back when I was doing the dissertation project with self-weighing. Some of the women discussed having a scale without numbers. And I think another potential future direction that could be really interesting here is looking at how a scale that maybe tells people you're maintaining your weight, you're gaining weight, or you're losing weight could be more beneficial or less beneficial as a tracking mechanism instead of a scale with numerical information. So to summarize all of this information, the preponderance of literature suggests that weighing seems to help some individuals with weight control. But at the same time, I think data like this that I presented from Project EAT suggests that there might be others, and from today it seems like those might be females and younger females for whom we need to be more careful in recommending this as a strategy. So my future work aims to better identify those individuals for whom weighing is helpful and for whom weighing is not as helpful so that we can use this as a relatively time and cost-effective strategy to help individuals lead healthier and more productive lives and feel better. Thank you all very much for listening, and now I can open up for questions.
Great. Thank you, Carly, for a lovely presentation and a nice overview of self-weighing across the lifespan, really, from age 15 to 25. And I'm really interested to hear what you find with the 15-year follow-up findings that you're currently working on.
Thanks.
So, currently, as you suggested, it seems that there are some groups that may be more sensitized to self-weighing and how that might affect their psychological outcomes. And I know you're planning on investigating that in your future work, but for the majority of us that may be nutrition health educators and counsel patients or are out in the field, you know, promoting community nutrition health, what type of recommendations would you give regarding self-weighing and monitoring one's weight?
I think that currently the state of the evidence suggests that for adults, so adults, you know, 40 years and over, if the group seems to, I really think it comes down to an individual level call and people using their clinical expertise to feel out the situation with the individual. So when you said community health workers, I was kind of thinking of groups and things. But I think that when talking with an individual and feeling out their situation, that it is something that in some situations could and should be recommended and could be helpful. And the type of people that I've seen this work well with are usually older adults, not older, but middle-aged adults who maybe don't have as much experience with weight and their behaviors, who don't seem to be overly concerned or focused on their weight, but maybe they're coming in because their doctor said, hey, you have a problem with your weight and you need to reduce it, and maybe they don't know how to do that. But I think working in conjunction with a healthcare provider and monitoring their weight, whether it's daily, whether it's weekly, figuring out what works for them, can be really like a learning experience for that individual to track and see, oh, this is how my behaviors relate to my weight. And looking at that over time with the supervision of a healthcare provider can be really beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Great. What do you think about any of the younger, like adolescents? I know you had mentioned there were some differences in boys and girls and how they responded to self-weighing.
Mm-hmm. So I think now I would, and some of my colleagues who are more in the weight control field would probably be less cautious, but given these Project EAT findings and some other findings, I always err on the side of caution because I think that we don't want to do any harm. And I think self-weighing is a really interesting controversy because on one side of the coin, we do have high levels of overweight and obesity, and they're increasing among all age groups, and emerging adults are at risk for gaining weight across the lifespan. So if self-weighing does work as a regulatory strategy, it would be a great thing to implement. I'm just not comfortable across the board saying, let's have them all weigh themselves, because I think we need to learn more about the individual factors that predict response. And there's actually one study that I'm basing the EMA study off of. This was published by Strimis and Dion in 2010, which looked at and found that dietary restraint, so cognitive control over eating and kind of like the sense of dieting, was one factor that differentiated response, at least response in terms of weight gain or weight loss, to self-weighing. So those with less dietary restraint lost weight, and those with higher dietary restraint actually gained weight. So that's the only moderating factor that I know of to date, and I think that's a really interesting finding because maybe for people who are more attuned to weight and eating and health and calorie counting, maybe they should not be weighing themselves that frequently. But maybe for people who don't have their head in the nutrition game, weighing and tracking their weight might be a useful learning experience. I just think it's a tool that could be helpful for some. I don't think we're at the stage, to answer your question, where we can recommend this at a population level.
All right, thanks. So we do have one question from a listener, Dr. Barbaros. She was curious as to why not consider measuring function instead of looking specifically at self-weighing or one's weight. So as an example, ability to walk a certain distance or ability to run. So instead of just focusing on the weight or a number on the scale, looking at other health outcomes like function and so forth.
Okay.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. That's a great question. That actually is very relevant to my overall research interests, because my overall question is, do numbers motivate health behavior? And weight is one of those numbers. But it kind of gets at the question, should we focus on weight or should we focus on health, which I think is what the listener pointed out. And there are kind of two camps. There are those who strongly believe we need to focus on weight as an objective outcome, and from a research perspective, I can see that. But then there are also groups like Health at Any Size that really want to focus on well-being. And I see measures of, I know the listener proposed a functional measure like walking, but I'm also looking at measures as like body satisfaction and quality. I've also looked at quality of life in the study, so quality of life does take into account ability to do daily activities and engage in social things and the amount of connectedness. So those are things that I'm measuring in future studies. And I'm also investigating ways other than behaviors other than self-weighing that might promote health. So something on the complete other end of the spectrum, self-weighing being very quantitative, is something like yoga. And we're running a study next semester to look at how yoga might be related to weight outcomes, but also body satisfaction, feelings of connectedness, and some of these more health-related outcomes.
Okay, great.
And there's
Thank you.
I'm sorry, just to point out to this listener, there was an article published, I think it's 2015, and if this listener wants to email me, I'd be happy to share the article. A really great article looking at a weight loss trial and randomizing, I think it was adult women, to either a weight-focused or a non-weight-focused approach and looking at outcomes, and it had some fascinating findings.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another question. They wanted to ask you, you had mentioned a lot about how your current study included a more diverse population than most other research studies. They were curious as to know whether or not you stratified any responses by race and ethnicity, or if you found any variability in responses among the differing races and ethnicities.
So that's a really good question. And when I was conceptualizing and writing the proposal for the EAT study, that was actually one of the goals. And unfortunately, even though Project EAT is one of the most diverse samples, we didn't have the statistical power to look at race as a moderator. So we weren't able to do that. And unfortunately, that's also the case for EAT4. But something I will say that I'm working on currently with, I also have been looking at self-weighing in eating disorder communities, and there's a large sample of individuals with binge eating disorder, and that sample is racially and ethnically diverse enough to look at rates of self-weighing by race, and I did find a significant difference, but that paper is currently underway.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you make any comment towards the literature as to whether or not there are differences in when it comes to psychological outcomes and race and ethnicity, if there have been other studies that looked into that?
In terms of self-weighing and outcomes on weight?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a really fertile area for further investigation. I don't know of any. I think that's one of really important future directions here. There could be some that I'm not aware of. I'm not comfortable saying that there aren't any. But I think that just most of the weight loss literature and the things that we know about weight loss focus on Caucasian individuals, and I think any studies that look at other groups and how relationship to weight and eating might differ and might have a completely different way of operating are really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. So do you have any thoughts on future research in this area? I know you mentioned some of the work that you're planning on doing. I was unfamiliar with you had mentioned the momentary. Could you describe that in more detail on how that works?
Sure. So part of the training that I did in Fargo, North Dakota, was with a group. They're actually eating disorder researchers, but they've developed a system. The system really allows for ecological momentary assessment. So ecological momentary assessment originated by these two researchers, Schiffman and Stone, I think published the first paper about it, I think in 1994, but I could get that reference for you if you're interested. Okay. And it's really just collecting information real time. So when we think about psychological measures and measures of well-being, like quality of life, it's usually over the past 6 months or over the past week, but there are ways that we can ask right now. So we know that there are state-like and trait-like psychological variables, and things like mood, like level of anxiety, level of distress, level of nervousness, jitteriness, can fluctuate within a day. And so ecological momentary assessments allow us to do an intervention that might affect mood and then measure people's mood right after, and then maybe later in the day. So there's ways to do it around a behavior and then also randomly throughout the day. And this group that I work with has conducted studies in populations with anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder, and obesity. And what's really interesting about this ecological momentary assessment is they'll give the population, they don't do interventions in that sense, they do cohort studies. They'll track the individuals over maybe a two-week period and have the individuals record each time they have an eating disorder-related event. And then they'll also send random signals when the participants will log in and record their mood. So what they were able to find from this is that if you look at one point, like point analyses like we traditionally do versus curves, if you have a lot of different data and you can do growth modeling, they found that negative affect increases before an eating disorder behavior like a binge and purge episode and then decreases afterwards. And that wasn't able to be seen just looking at the single point self-report analyses. EMA is also really beneficial in that it gets around retrospective recall bias from questionnaires. So it's a really powerful methodology, and I think there's some exciting things that can be done in health and nutrition research.
Yeah, now how do they respond? Is it, do they have to log into, you know, the website and, you know, record that, or is it via phone, an app, or anything? I'm curious.
Yeah, so there are apps, and I'm currently working on designing which questions I'm going to ask, because a lot of the traditional questions don't really fit, because you want quick questions. It's basically like on your cell phone, like the systems are iOS and Android compatible, I think, and you can get a prompt on their phone, and then they just quick go through. And things like the PANAS from psychology, the positive and negative affect schedule, are easy to do with EMA, and I've actually done paper versions of EMA using that, but it'll ask, on a scale of 1 to 5, how angry are you right now? And people can easily just go through and click.
Okay. Very interesting. So... well, thank you. I think we're kind of running a little short on time, but I'm sure if there are more questions, they have your email, so they could definitely reach out to you. And I just want to thank you again for sharing with us some of your work in this area, and I wish you best of luck in continuing working on this.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you guys for listening.
All right, I'll let Rachel close out today's session.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah, just a reminder, there'll be a short survey when I close out the webinar, and then watch for an email from me on Wednesday with the follow-up material as well as your CEU certificate. And then no journal club next week. So we're back in 2 weeks with a qualitative investigation of parents' perspective about feeding practices with siblings among racially, ethnically, and socioeconomically diverse households. And we are finalizing our schedule for the spring semester, which will look at policies, systems, and environmental change initiatives and programs to improve health. So hopefully I'll have a notice out next week for folks to start registering for next semester. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you.